Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome to the Inside Scoop on Washington. This is Mark Levine reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington. It was a busy night of television viewing last night. I stayed up really late. I don't know if you did too. I had to watch the Republican debate, which is mostly what we're going to talk about. But also, you know, I had to watch Jon Stewart's last show as a good and faithful viewer of The Daily Show for more than a decade now. Had to see the final show. It wasn't that big a deal if you missed it, honestly. It was mostly just thank yous and sort of a tearful goodbye. It really wasn't that funny or that memorable. But Jon Stewart certainly was funny and memorable. And his wit and wisdom and his ability to skewer others will be missed. I'm not just by me. I think I clearly know that tens of millions of Americans will miss that. And frankly, watching the debate last night, my one thought was, boy, I wish Jon Stewart was around to skewer this. There was a lot to talk about. We're going to go over the debate as much as I can play for it. Obviously, it was a three-hour debate, and I'm not going to play every bit of it. But I'm going to play a lot of it for you today to see, you know, if you missed some of it, because it was 3 hours, and sort of give you the highlights of it. And then come Monday, we're having a special three-hour Inside Scoop, where I'm going to hear your thoughts, and I want to hear your thoughts on each of the candidates, on how they did, on your general impressions of the debate. Let me start with my general impressions of the debate. I think the person or entity or most interesting thing from last night's debate was not the candidates on stage. I think it was the moderators. I think it was the Fox News debate. It was fascinating to me to see them try to control what's becoming a very uncontrollable party. No question, whoever wrote the questions for that Fox News debate wanted Jeb Bush to win, wanted Donald Trump to fail. But I'm not so sure they succeeded. Because it seems to me that the more the I was going to say the authorities. It really is the authorities of the moderators of the Fox News debate, the establishment, the media, whatever it is. The more they want to take down Donald Trump, I think the more he rises. And I have to say, and I never really thought I'd say this, I now get why some people support Donald Trump for president. Not, I think, because any rational human being would want Donald Trump to be president. He's clearly too bombastic, too inexperienced, too much shoots off the cuff. He certainly does not have the temperament to be president. But he does have the temperament of someone who is unfiltered, someone who will say what's on his mind, someone who's, as he says, unafraid of political correctness. And we all are around people that in their day-to-day lives say things that are, what can I say, insulting, right? The famous question, we'll get to it, where Megyn Kelly asks him about the awful things he said about women. And he's just willing to say publicly what most people would only say privately. And therein lies his appeal. It's got nothing to do with his positions on the issues. It has to do with the fact that he is speaking as real people speak in their private homes and doing so publicly. And yeah, he's uninformed. Real people speaking in their private homes, often uninformed. And yeah, he's insulting. Yeah, real people in private homes often are insulting. But it doesn't sound like a politician. And even though we sometimes need a politician to be a little more careful than Donald Trump is, I get it. I get it. There's a certain aggressiveness that I think many in the American polity hunger for, and particularly in the Republican Party. Now, I say this as someone who has been called an aggressive progressive. So I guess I'm defending a little bit a willingness to speak honestly, to speak on your mind, to say what you really feel. It's not at all advocating Trump refusing to answer the questions, which he completely did, and going off the cuff. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with going off the cuff. What Donald Trump does is he conveys I'm not being careful. I just say what I'm thinking. And he does it better than anyone. And the show last night was very much like a reality show. Frankly, the audience played a major role in the debate last night. There are debates, we've seen them, where the moderators urge the room to stay quiet so as not to impact on the debate. Those are very different debates. If you saw the first debate, what they call the kiddie table debate, the one of the seven candidates who were not in the top 10 in the polls, there was virtually no one in the room watching that debate. And it was very, very quiet. And it was a much more, I guess, reasoned debate. But when you have a crowd of cheering people, people play to the crowd. I play to the crowd. I admit it. I love live audiences. I talk on the radio. On the radio, I don't get that feedback from you that I, like most people who speak, love. I admit it. I'm not going to deny it. Like Bill Clinton, like Donald Trump, like any politician, or any good public speaker, we love to hear the feedback. You make a joke, you hear the audience laugh. That's reassuring. You make a fiery statement and the audience cheers. That's reassuring. You say something awful and the audience gasps. Any stage actor understands exactly what I'm talking about. And the audience played a major role in the booing and the cheering and the raucousness. It was probably more like a worldwide wrestling match than it was like a debate. The candidates regularly avoided the questions. And what I found is that the hosts, the moderators, pushed Donald Trump to answer their questions, and he didn't, but let Jeb Bush completely off the hook. There's no question in my mind that Bret Baier, Megyn Kelly, and Chris Wallace were doing their best to make Jeb Bush look good. And listen, Jeb Bush is the likely Republican nominee. Whoever is running these debates very much wants Jeb Bush to be the nominee. That was very, very clear to me. Just to give you the clearest example, each of the candidates has said some pretty extreme things. And many of them were asked questions about the extreme things they said. Certainly Donald Trump was. Certainly Scott Walker was. Scott Walker supports abortion, supports banning abortion, even when the mother's life is in danger. Let that run through your head for the moment. Okay? You've got a 25-year-old woman. She's got two kids and a loving husband and parents and friends and cousins. And she gets pregnant again for the third time. And this fetus, as happens medically, develops a condition that threatens the mother's life. Remember, prior to the 1960s or so in modern medicine, maybe the 1930s, prior to the last century, one out of six women would die in childbirth. It was very, very common. There are things that develop in the womb that threaten a mother's life. So this 25-year-old woman, she's got two kids. She's got a husband. She's got lots of loving family. Scott Walker would say, die, woman, die. If it's the fetus or you, sacrifice the woman. Who needs a 25-year-old birthing vehicle when we can create a new life? Not really understanding, I guess, that there's trillions of sperm and millions of eggs, well, billions of eggs, wasted every day that could create a new life. But this billionth and this trillionth, that's more important than a living, loving, breathing woman. That's extraordinary. And they asked Walker about his extraordinary position, and he defended it. But they didn't ask Jeb Bush why he wants to end Medicare. To me, that's an extremist position. Jeb Bush, the leading candidate for Republican. I know Donald Trump's leading in the polls. Sorry, Jeb Bush is the leading candidate. The leading candidate, the person most likely to win the Republican nomination, wants to end Medicare. Probably the single most popular government program. I don't know if it's more or less popular than Social Security. I do know that well north of 90% of people on Medicare like their Medicare. And if you don't believe me, go ask someone over the age of 65. Just ask them. Parents, grandparents, your friends, your neighbors. Ask someone over 65 if they like their Medicare. And you'll be so shocked to find that even the most conservative ones generally like their Medicare. Jeb Bush wants to end this program. That's a shocking statement. If Fox News hosts really wanted to press him on this, they could have. But they didn't. They asked him very benign questions about Common Core and a whole bunch of boring things. And Jeb Bush came off boring. And I wonder actually whether that will hurt him. I wonder whether in the scrum of a worldwide wrestling audience, which is not only the people in Cleveland, but largely the people who are voting in the Republican nomination, I wonder whether he'll be looked over because people want that kind of outside-the-box, unfiltered thinking that Donald Trump gives. The winner of the debate, the clear, hands-down winner of the debate, Governor Kasich of Ohio. Who? You say who? Yeah, Governor Kasich. He just entered the race. I think he was 10th in the polls. Governor Kasich came on that stage and sounded like a human being. He sounded somewhat reasonable. I'm a Democrat. He's a Republican. We disagree on some things. But he actually showed compassion for people less fortunate. Crazy, I know. Republicans are all about destroying the lives of those less fortunate. Not Governor John Kasich. He actually talked like a reasonable person. Kasich reminds me very much of the role that John Huntsman played. Remember John Huntsman in the last debate? The guy that ran against Mitt Romney and always sounded kind of reasonable and got, I don't know, third, fourth, fifth, sixth in the polls. That's the role John Kasich plays. John Kasich recognized that the people in Ohio shouldn't turn down billions of dollars in health care. So he took the Medicaid expansion offered by the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, and he showed real compassion, even on some of the things where he was defending a party line, like being opposed to same-sex marriage. He admitted he would go and has gone to such a marriage. He talked about real empathy for others. As such, I just think John Kasich will probably soon be kicked out of the Republican Party. Republican Party is all about survival of the fittest. It's about Spartan social Darwinism. It's about putting your fellow man down and stepping on his face so you can climb higher. That's the Republican Party that was represented in Cleveland. John Kasich made sense. John Kasich showed compassion. John Kasich easily answered the questions and easily won the debate. I'm confident John Kasich has no chance of winning the Republican nomination. When we come back, we'll be playing clips from the debate, including the fantastic, amazing, shocking, and really unfair opening question to Donald Trump. Maybe it was fair. I don't know. We'll see what you think. The question about whether he would run as a third-party candidate. We'll be right back with that right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, talking about the Republican debate last night. I'm going to play a number of clips from it. To me, the most interesting part of the debate, and it was an interesting debate, I can't deny it, was not the candidates. It was the setting. It was the questions asked by the Fox News moderators. It was the audience cheering and booing in the theater. It made for great television. Whatever you can say about Fox News, you can't deny their entertainment skills. And the questions tended to ask certain candidates things that they didn't want to hear, as I said, with the exception of Jeb Bush, who got all softballs. But let's start with the very first question of the night, where you see the moderators really try to persuade Republican voters not to vote for Donald Trump because he has said that if he's treated unfairly, he will run as a third-party candidate. Now, he's made very clear that that will happen if he's treated unfairly. And I fully admit, as a Democrat, that I would love to see a Donald Trump third-party run. I think that would help the Democrats. But that's my rule, that's my opinion as a pundit. I was very down on Ralph Nader, I think, for making sure that Al Gore's margin in 2000, even though Gore won that election, was in the margin of stealing. And, of course, the Supreme Court did steal that election. So I know that third-party candidates tend to hurt the party to which they're most closely affiliated. But I say that as a pundit. A neutral reporter would never say such a thing. I say it because, well, I believe it. And actually, I'm even harming my wish, because my wish is that Donald Trump wins the Republican nomination. I think he would be an easy one to beat if the Democrats win. But I'm being very honest with you here. Fox News host really shouldn't be playing the role of trying to persuade Republicans not to vote for Donald Trump. But how else can you explain, well, the very opening question of the debate?
Is there anyone on stage, and can I see hands, who is unwilling tonight to pledge your support to the eventual nominee of the Republican Party and pledge to not run an independent campaign against that person? Again, we're looking for you to raise your hand now. Raise your hand now if you won't make that pledge tonight.
So the audience, by their immediate reaction, knows exactly what Brett Baer is up to, right? They know this is designed entirely to single out Donald Trump, and indeed Donald Trump is the only person to raise his hand.
Mr. Trump. So, Mr. Trump, to be clear, you're standing on a Republican primary
debate. I fully understand.
The place where the RNC will give the nominee the nod.
I fully understand.
And that experts say an independent run would almost certainly hand the race over to Democrats and likely another Clinton. You can't say tonight that you can make that pledge.
I cannot say. I have to respect the person that, if it's not me, the person that wins. If I do win and I'm leading by quite a bit, that's what I want to do. I can totally make that pledge. If I'm the nominee, I will pledge I will not run as an independent. But and I am discussing it with everybody. But I'm, you know, talking about a lot of leverage. We want to win and we will win. But I want to win as the Republican. I want to run as the Republican nominee.
So tonight you can't say if another one of these.
This is what's wrong. I mean, okay. This is what's wrong. He buys and sells politicians of all stripes. He's already.
Dr. Paul.
Hey, look. He's already hedging his bet on the Clintons, okay? So if he doesn't run as a Republican, maybe he supports Clinton or maybe runs as an independent.
Okay.
But I'd say that he's already hedging his bets because he's used to buying politicians.
Well, I've given him plenty of money.
Just to be clear, you can't make the. We're going to move on. You're not going to make the pledge tonight.
I will not make the pledge at this time.
Okay.
And so was the opening to the Republican debate, a very exciting one to be sure. We'll talk about that and play more from it right after. I'm your host, Mark Levine. So Trump's answer to the question of whether he would run as a third-party candidate was very interesting. It was very honest, for one thing. I mean, he could have said, yeah, I'll support the Republican nominee, then lost, and then said, you know what, I changed my mind, they treated me unfairly, and I'm going to run as a third-party candidate. He didn't say that. He said from the get-go, yeah, I may run as a third-party candidate. His reasoning is fascinating. He said it gives him leverage. And no doubt it does. There is nothing the Republican Party would be more afraid of, once Jeb Bush is the nominee, than having Donald Trump run as a third-party candidate. And no doubt they would do something to pacify him. Later on, he talks about how he uses money to buy politicians. Again, very frank, very honest, very direct about the way our current system works. When Rand Paul, complains that this is the guy who buys and sells politicians, he says, basically, you're damn right. That's the system. That's the way it works. I don't support that system. And in that way, he actually comes very close to my views. I also don't support the system of legal bribery, and it's perfectly legal. It's perfectly legal. I don't support that system in our elections. But that's the way it goes, and that brutal honesty, I think, is what appeals to people. My choice, my favorite candidate, the one that I felt, and maybe this is the kiss of death for him, the fact that I like him, but compare the bombast of a Donald Trump with a reasonable human being. Again, I'm praising this guy far more. If he wins the nomination, I'm sure I'll still support Hillary Clinton. Luckily, I just don't think the Republicans are reasonable, nice enough, or empathetic enough to choose Governor John Kasich of Ohio, the ultimate swing state, as their nominee. But if they were, listen to the kind of reasonable Republican who I think would easily beat Hillary Clinton.
Governor Kasich, you chose to expand Medicaid in your state, unlike several other governors on this stage tonight, and it is already over budget by some estimates, costing taxpayers an additional $1.4 billion in just the first 18 months. You defended your Medicaid expansion by invoking God, saying to skeptics that when they arrive in heaven, St. Peter isn't going to ask them how small they've kept government, but what they have done for the poor. Why should Republican voters, who generally want to shrink government, believe that you won't use your St. Peter rationale to expand every government program?
Well,
first of all, I want you to note the question from Megyn Kelly. All right? She's taking what is clearly a compassionate, beneficial thing the governor did and trying to attack it every way she can. She's attacking it on the matter of cost. Of course, it actually saves states money to accept this money. The money is all, you can agree or disagree with Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. You can agree or disagree with it. But if anything, this is federal taxpayers who've already paid for it. If governors refuse to allow it in their states, they're costing their taxpayers more money. So on the issue of cost, she's, of course, dead wrong. But she's trying to frame it in such a way that it supports the Republican agenda. Very, very non-neutral question. And note how she's attacking the fact that John Kasich said he's doing it out of compassion, that he believes that compassion for the poor is a Christian value. And she's actually going and attacking his religious sense that caring for the poor is something he believes in. Again, I think it's actually uncontroversial that Christianity and Judaism and Islam and all of the world's great religions believes in care for the poor. And yet, I just want you to notice how much the question is non-neutral before we hear John Kasich answer it. So let's just play the question one more time, and then we'll go right to Kasich's answer.
Taxpayers an additional $1.4 billion in just the first 18 months. You defended your Medicaid expansion by invoking God, saying to skeptics that when they arrive in heaven, St. Peter isn't going to ask them how small they've kept government, but what they have done for the poor. Why should Republican voters, who generally want to shrink government, believe that you won't use your St. Peter rationale to expand every government program?
Well, first of all, Megan, you should know that that President Reagan expanded Medicaid three or four times. Secondly, I had an opportunity to bring resources back to Ohio to do what? To treat the mentally ill. 10,000 of them sit in our prisons. It costs $22,500 a year to keep them in prison. I'd rather get them their medication so they could lead a decent life.
Wow. Wow, did you hear that? He advocated for treating the mental ill with compassion. A Republican actually pointed out the obvious, that allowing mentally ill people to take drugs is less expensive than putting them in prison after they've shot a bunch of people dead. Wow. Wow. Obviously true, but who expects a Republican to say things like that? He goes on.
Secondly, we are rehabbing the drug addicted. 80% of the people in our prisons have addiction problems. We now treat them in the prisons, release them in the community, and the recidivism rate is 10%. And everybody across this country knows that the tsunami of drugs is threatening their very families. So we're treating them and getting them on their feet. And finally, the working poor, instead of them having come into the emergency rooms where it costs more, where they're sicker and we end up paying, we brought a program in here to make sure that people could get on their feet. And you know what? Everybody has a right to their God-given purpose. And finally, our Medicaid is growing at one of the lowest rates.
Actually, let me just stop each one because all these points are so good. They're the points I make all the time right here on this show. So first, he points out that treating the mentally ill with drugs, which often treat a physiological need, is less expensive than putting them in prison. Yeah, you can do it for compassionate reasons. That's a liberal argument. You can do it because it saves money. That's the conservative argument. Number two, he brings up that putting people in prison for abuse of drugs is far more expensive than giving them treatment. Again, obvious. Again, compassionate, but also fiscally conservative. Number three, he points out that recidivism, the rate at which people who leave jails, felons and ex-cons, if they go back to jail, they commit crimes again. If we don't help prisoners escape, if we don't help prisoners who have just left jail, who've served their time, escape the crime-ridden environment that will get them to go back to prison, I'll be very clear. I don't want anyone to take these words out of context. We've got to help prisoners escape the cycle. The way it is now, an ex-con leaves prison. He served his time. He then gets no money. He gets just the shirt on his back. He gets no job. We make it easy, too easy, for employers just to not even consider hiring him. Many have like a box on a form. And if you're an ex-felon, they just check off the box and you don't even have a chance of being hired and explain yourself. So they don't get a job. They can't take care of themselves. What do? They go back to their old ways. They have no friends other than the very friends that got them in trouble in the first place. They go back to a life of crime. They go back to jail. Now, as a liberal, we look at that and we say we compassionately need to give people a second chance. They've served their time. They need to be able to rejoin society. That's not the way a conservative looks at it. But even the way a conservative should look at it leads to us having halfway houses and other things to help people who've left jails. Why? Because recidivism, the rate at which people who've left prison go back to prison, is extremely expensive. It costs money. Jails are very, very expensive. If we can help keep someone out of jail at a fraction of the cost of them going to jail, even if we don't give a damn about the human being, even if we have zero compassion and zero empathy, that is going to save some money. And then he goes on to talk about the benefits of Medicaid expansion. What it means is that people won't be using the emergency room, which costs taxpayers and insurance payers and you and me a lot of money. I've long talked about the fact if you can get heart medicine for $100 a month, it's a lot cheaper than getting emergency quintuple heart bypass surgery, which might cost you $65,000, not to mention they drill a hole down the middle of your chest and you'll be in pain for several years after, maybe the rest of your life. But forget the pain, forget the compassion. It saves the taxpayer money. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I have long argued that the liberal programs that I support for compassionate reasons also make sense for fiscally conservative reasons. We liberals are fiscal conservatives. We put saving money ahead of destroying people's lives. The basic conservative argument is, you know what? They went to prison, they should suffer. They have cancer, they should suffer. They're poor, they should suffer. They're not white or straight or Christian, they should suffer. The liberal argument is, now wait a minute, if we bring everybody in and treat everybody fairly and give everybody a second chance and give everyone basic preventive health care, yeah, you can do it for compassionate reasons, but you also save money. And unless you're out to simply brutally destroy people's lives, unless that's your goal, if your only goal is to be a fiscal conservative and to save money, the liberal way is the way. Way to go, Governor John Kasich. If I were voting the Republican primary, you'd definitely have my vote. Let's hear again what he has to say.
Four times. Secondly, I had an opportunity to bring resources back to Ohio to do what? To treat the mentally ill. 10,000 of them sit in our prisons. It costs $22,500 a year to keep them in prison. I'd rather get them their medication so they could lead a decent life. Secondly, we are rehabbing the drug addicted. 80% of the people in our prisons have addiction problems. We now treat them in the prisons, release them in the community, and the recidivism rate is 10%. And everybody across this country knows that the tsunami of drugs is threatening their very families.
You hear that? 80% of people in prison have drug issues. They treat them in the prison, they come out, and they don't go back to prison.
So we're treating them and getting them on their feet. And finally, the working poor, instead of them having come into the emergency rooms where it costs more, where they're sicker and we end up paying, we brought a program in here to make sure that people could get on their feet.
The name of that program is Obamacare. He's smart not to give its name. Call it the Affordable Care Act. Better yet, don't mention its name, because Republicans will do anything. It seems like they'll destroy their grandma if their grandma likes Obama. So don't put the president's name in. Let's just be very, very quiet and recognize how many people it helps.
And you know what? Everybody has a right to their God-given purpose. And finally, our Medicaid is growing at one of the lowest rates in the country. And finally, we went from $8 billion in the hole to $2 billion in the black. We've cut $5 billion in taxes, and we've grown 350,000 jobs.
Gentlemen, we're turning.
Now, that, of course, is in Ohio, of which he's the governor. But I have to say, I think he made a compelling case. So compelling that I think he has no chance of becoming the Republican nominee. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back with more debate coverage right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I realize I've just scratched the surface of this debate. There's a lot of meat there. It was a three-hour debate, and I realize I had no time to take calls today. I apologize for that. We're going to have 3 full hours on Monday to go over a lot more of the debate, to take your calls, to hear more of my analysis, for me to hear your analysis of who you think won and what you thought of the atmospherics. Because, again, I thought the atmospherics were in many ways more interesting than the debate itself. Let me show you one of the most interesting exchanges I found between two wings of the Republican Party, the so-called National Security Wing and the so-called Constitutional Wing. And I found this really fascinating because generally when it comes to internationalism versus isolationism, I'm the internationalist. I believe the United States does have a role to play in foreign policy, and I recognize that that divide, internationalism versus isolationism, runs down both parties. Both liberals and conservatives are split on the issue of how involved the United States should be in foreign policy. But on the issue of the Constitution, I am a strict constructionist. I believe the Fourth Amendment should be followed. I think that people shouldn't be spied on without a warrant. So in this case, yeah, I agree with Rand Paul against Chris Christie. Listen to their exchange. I think it very much typifies the exchange you're going to be hearing for decades to come.
Governor Christie, you've said that Senator Paul's opposition to the NSA's collection of phone records has made the United States weaker and more vulnerable, even going so far as to say that he should be called before Congress to answer for it if we should be hit by another terrorist attack. Do you really believe you can assign blame to Senator Paul just for opposing the bulk collection of people's phone records in the event of a terrorist attack?
Yes, I do. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm the only person on this stage who's actually filed applications under the Patriot Act, who have gone before the federal, the Foreign Intelligence Service Court, who has prosecuted and investigated and jailed terrorists in this country after September 11th. I was appointed U.S. Attorney by President Bush on September 10th, 2001. And the world changed enormously the next day. And it happened in my state. This is not theoretical to me. I went to the funerals. We lost friends of ours in the Trade Center that day. My own wife was two blocks from the Trade Center that day at her office, having gone through it that morning. When you actually have to be responsible for doing this, you can do it, and we did it for 7 years in my office, respecting civil liberties and protecting the homeland. And I will make no apologies ever for protecting the lives and the safety of the American people. We have to give more tools to our folks to be able to do that, not fewer, and then trust those people and oversee them to do it the right way. As president, that is exactly what I'll do.
Megan, may I respond?
Go ahead, sir.
I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from innocent Americans. The Fourth Amendment was what we fought the revolution over. John Adams said it was the spark that led to our war for independence. And I'm proud of standing for the Bill of Rights, and I will continue to stand for the Bill of Rights.
And Megan, that's a completely ridiculous answer. I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from other people. How are you supposed to know, Megan?
Use the Fourth Amendment.
How are you supposed
to? Use the Fourth Amendment.
No, I'll tell you how you.
Get a warrant.
Let me tell you something.
Get a judge to sign a warrant.
You know, Senator.
Go ahead, wait, Governor Christie, make your point.
Listen, Senator, you know, when you're sitting in a subcommittee just blowing hot air about this, you can say things like that. When you're responsible for protecting the lives of the American people, then what you need to do is to make sure that
here's
you use the system the way it's supposed to.
Here's the problem, Governor. You fundamentally misunderstand the Bill of Rights. Every time you did a case, you got a warrant from a judge. I'm talking about searches without warrants, indiscriminately of all Americans' records, and that's what I fought to end. I don't trust President Obama with our records. I know you gave him a big hug, and if you want to give him a big hug again, go right ahead.
Go ahead, Governor.
Senator Paul, you know, the hugs that I remember are the hugs that I gave to the families who lost their people on September 11th. Those are the hugs I remember. And those had nothing to do, with politics. Unlike what you're doing by cutting speeches on the floor of the Senate, then putting them on the internet within a half an hour to raise money for your campaign.
All right.
And while still putting our country at risk.
All right, we're going to cut it off there.
Done.
We have plenty more we want to get to. That was an interesting exchange. Thank you for that. Well, I want to move on because we're going to get to you, Governor, but I really want to get to a Facebook questioner.
So that was an interesting exchange. And I have to say, I agree with Rand Paul. I do think you need a warrant. I think Governor Christie was avoiding that question. But what I do think is fascinating is sort of all the unfair attacks, right? You hugged President Obama. Now, we know that when Superstorm Sandy came and destroyed a huge amount of New Jersey property, and President Obama had the federal government help the people of New Jersey rebuild, we know that the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, was thankful, and at one point had his arm around him. He may have even given him a hug. And I just want you to note that this is what goes for evil in the Republican Party. Working together with the President of the United States to help your constituents who are suffering through no fault of their own. I want you to think about that. You can't greet someone. I wasn't much of a hug. It was more of a... But whatever. That is seen as the enemy of the Republican Party. And I would say that until we find a Republican Party who's willing to work across the aisle, I mean, Hillary Clinton, whatever you think about her, has constantly worked across the aisle. Democrats, President Obama has reached out to Republicans. Democrats are constantly reaching out to Republicans. And Republicans are saying the mere act of working together with your fellow Americans to make America a better place is a bad thing to do. That shows you where the Republican Party is these days. We're going to have full analysis of the debate, many more clips, and your calls on Monday. Do not miss a special 3-hour show. This clip, like all of mine, will be on my website at marklevinetalk.com. Follow me on Twitter at marklevinetalk.